Today we are going to receive a briefing from the department. Maybe before we do that, there are a few things that maybe we need just to clarify and go through. That this morning I was informed that the request has been forwarded to us to request that we change the meeting, given the fact that the department was going to have a meeting in with the NCOP. And I said to the deputy minister, it was the first time it was news to me to hear that the request has been forwarded to my office. So I want to place on record that we never received such a request, and we're never told. And therefore, there was no possibility for us to change the meeting, unknown to us that there was a problem. The second aspect is that, deputy minister, we've said in a number of times that we will not accept nor agree to be briefed by any other official except the political office bearers and the DG. And in an event that the DG has to brief the committee, we agreed that they will then be informed on time to make those particular arrangements, so that we know that there are certain circumstances that have arisen, and therefore there are those changes. We find it quite difficult and unacceptable that until yesterday, after we've made several inquiries, that we only told yesterday that the chief director will come and brief the committee. And in fact, it was because we've been insisting to get to know who's coming before the committee. The second aspect is that at that point in time, we pointed out and reminded the department through your parliamentary liaison office of the fact that we will want the deputy minister to come and brief the committee. We therefore said that there was at any given time, a rumor, it has been our considered opinion that we should advise that we have a standing decision. And this decision has been taken long time ago, given the problems that the committee 24 hours before the presentation to be told who's coming to brief the committee. The second aspect that we've always requested is to receive documentation in time. That it does not help us as the portfolio committee to receive documents as we sit down, because effectively we are not able to engage the documents. I understand that the purpose of the meeting is for us to engage the briefing, but if the engagement means asking clarity questions to me, that's not a quality engagement. And we want to insist that we get documents in time. I want to place before you, Deputy Minister, and to the committee as a whole, that in future when we don't get documents in time, we'll not be able to proceed with the meeting until such time that the department takes our request very seriously, that we want documents in time, and we want documents to be provided to us so that we can prepare an engagement and oversight work that we need to do. In an event that has not been done, we'll not be able to proceed with meetings unless we get documentation in time. Thank you. Unless the Deputy Minister, you want to react to that.
Thank you very much. Chairperson, I was informed by the parliamentary officer in our office that there has been engagement between himself and the committee secretary regarding the fact that the next committee meeting was taking place simultaneously to the portfolio committee. I had understood that communication had been forwarded to you, and the response that we received was that now that the next committee, not a portfolio, could change the time. The next committee meeting from 10 to 12 and this one from 11 to 1, so there was an overlap of an hour. I made it clear that I would be at both meetings, and that should I be a bit late for this one, it was because of that problem. Secondly, we have a situation at the moment where our Director General is out of the country. Our Acting Director General is the DDG for Africa. He is therefore doing the presentation at the Select Committee and will be here when he is able to get across. But he is presenting the strategic plan on behalf of the department there. I'd further like to just point out that he is in fact confined to a wheelchair, so there are various logistical difficulties in him making himself available to two separate venues in two parts of the parliamentary complex. Chairperson, we have note of your request that only the DG or the political principal be submitted, and this is why I'm here today, in the absence of our director general. I have an email in front of me on the last matter that these documents were circulated yesterday morning to your office. I don't know whether you would have wanted this earlier than that, but there would have been preparation time of 24 hours. I'm not sure whether that didn't arrive, but certainly the email message that I have in front of me indicated was circulated 24 hours ago. So I think perhaps those are simply my responses to the questions that we can hand back to you.
Thank you. I'm going to leave that on that because the secretary is here. I will have asked her to respond, because if there's an email that indicates that at least 24 hours ago this document was circulated, then we need to find out why we did not receive it. All of us are just receiving this document as we sit down here, and I was advised that in fact. The question of a request, I would still want to see that request because I need to get to the bottom of it. I think there's too much loose ends and people make statements carelessly. I would want to see that request, and if your office could assist us to get that request, when it was made, where was it channeled to, so that we can make follow-ups on that. Because in my information that I have, it's not exactly what the Deputy Minister has. But we want to emphasize that we need to get these documents. We'll have to deal with the committee because I want to. This is the second time that we've been dealing with documentation problems. And I was promised that this matter will be taken care of. And if the document reaches just 24 hours, then we need to deal with it from the parliamentary side, if that is the case. Because otherwise there's no fruitful engagement if we only come to a meeting to ask clarity questions without engagement. With that note, we'll hand over to yourself, Deputy Minister, to take us through.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much. It's very, very good to be here in the committee, and the matter of Somalia is something that we very much part of the work that we've been doing in recent months today. The fact that a United Nations grouping was sent to Somalia just this week, I think, brings into focus the concern with which the international community views the circumstances in which Somalia finds itself. Our United Nations permanent representative in New York, Ambassador Somalo, was there with the other members of the team from the United Nations. And what we'd like to do is to describe a little bit about that mission and some of the events around the Security Council and the United Nations that are affecting Somalia. But first, I want to call you, Your Excellency. I'm still in the Department of Foreign Affairs, but I'm sure you won't mind if I do. Honourable Chairperson, I'm going to ask our Chief Director, Mr. Graham Mason, who is in charge of East Africa, and who's on a daily basis engaged in these matters, take us through a brief historical and political background of Somalia, and then get to a position where we discuss the current situation there, the political situation in Somalia, and how the different the different stakeholders in that country are engaged in the peace process, first of all, but also in continuing conflict in that country. I'd also then like, he will go then on to the relationship of Somalia in its own region, as well as with other countries of the world, which we think is very pertinent to the resolution of the problems there. So with your permission, Chairperson, I'd like to hand over to Mr. Mason to go through the presentation, which we have on PowerPoint, and which I understand everybody has now a copy of in front of them. Thank you.
you. Thank you, Deputy Minister. Thank you on the service of our members. As Deputy Minister stated, we perhaps thought the topic was to discuss the latest developments in Somalia, but we thought perhaps before we get to that, that we just do a context contextualization so that we draw some of the initiatives of the past and the present, so we can identify some of the, or analyze some of the difficulties that we face today in the peace process. As you know, that in 1960, the two former colonies of Britain and Italy formed the Somali Republic. Throughout the 60s, we've seen a serious political paralysis in the political situation in Somalia, which led to the to coup d'etat, which brought Mohamed Siad Barre to power. Now, in terms of the origins of the conflict, we can see that real opposition to Mohamed Barre to be emerged in 1977 after the Somali army were defeated in Ogaden Arena between Somalia and Ethiopia. As you know, in 1948, the Ogaden region was granted to Ethiopia by the British colonial power. And this war of 1977 was of course performed by Siad Barre to annex the Ogaden region of Ethiopia to create the Greater Somalia. The defeat of Mohamed Siad Barre marked the beginning of clan-based conflict with a group of Madafin sub-clan members attempting a coup against Barre's regime, which failed, of course, but resulted in the execution of many of the army officers. We also saw at the time that many of them fled Ethiopia, and some of them also to the Gulf region, and formed various groups, including Somali Salvation Democratic Front, led by the current president, Abdullah Yusuf Ahmed. And of course, as I said, others fled to the Gulf region, which in a way exposed them to, at that time, to the beginnings of Islamist politics of the time. So, by the late 1980s, we saw a plethora of opposition groups based on clan allegiances increasing their opposition to the government of Mohamed Siad Barre, which ultimately led to the collapse of the regime in 1991. And then, as you know, it's been quite popular description in the media that we saw an intensification of fighting among clans for power and resources in opposition. In May 1991, the Somali Patriotic Movement in the north, which is now currently Somali land, proclaimed independence. Subsequent to this, the international community has attempted on numerous occasions to bring peace to Somalia. We have seen 13 peace processes, which basically all failed, which in our view is mainly due to the tendency of the Somalis to rely on military solutions to their conflict and the non-inclusion of all Somalis in the decision-making final outcome of this process. The last process, called the Mbagathi process, which was led by the government of Kenya, led to the formation of the Transitional Federal Government and the adoption of the Transitional Federal Charter in 2004. Now, to bring us to the current political situation, since the formation of the PFG, we have really seen great paralysis in the functioning of the government. They have not been able to agree on setting up institutions, including security institutions, which has resulted that much of the security was provided by collectors of warlords and which are attached to the individuals within the PFG. Of course, this also coincided with the humanitarian crisis in the country through various parts of the last 14 or 15 years. And towards the end of 2006, we saw the emergence of what is called the Union of Islamic Force, which was an attempt by by them to establish or re-establish security and some semblance of governance in various parts of Somalia. Now, as you know, in end of December 2006, beginning January, the Union of Islamic Forces was expelled by the Ethiopian forces. As a result, the UIC dissolved and it re-emerged as part of an alliance, as part of the Alliance of the Liberation of Somalia, based in Asmara, and also somewhere based in Doha, in Qatar. In May 2007, in order to deal with the political crisis and the insecurity, the CFG launched the National Reconciliation Project Congress, which concluded in 2030 August 2007. Now, our own assessment, of course, of this reconciliation process is that it didn't succeed as planned for one or two particularly important reasons. One was the fact that there were fundamental differences between the CFG about who to include in the process. There were particular differences between the Prime Minister and the President, and also the Speaker of Parliament at that time. And so we saw that the members of the ARS, the UIC, at that time were not included in the talk. Also, another contributor to the failure of the Congress was the fact that there was a strong reliance or emphasis on planned politics without looking at a political movement, political party that transcends planned differences. Today, we see that despite the replacement of Mohamed Dewji, the former Prime Minister, and the appointment of Prime Minister Nuur, we see that the continuation of the divisions between the PSG, particularly related to the issue of the talks with the opposition. Now, maybe just to talk a little bit about the alliance for the liberation of Somalia. As we say, it's an alliance of elements of the UIP, the different members of the CFG. We've seen that, for example, the former Speaker of Parliament, Sheikh Adan, has joined the ARS in Asmara. Former warlords who are also members, of course, of the CFG and leaders of the Somali diaspora. Now, the strategy of ARS as an opposition movement really is centered on a dual political military approach. The military strategy, as you see, is basically led by the youth Mujahideen movement, also called Al-Shabaab, who is currently carrying out the insurgency in Somalia. And of course, the political arm of it is led by Sheikh Ahmed, who is based in Doha, and some figures based in Asmara. We have seen also in the last few months a significant scaling up of UN efforts to push for a peace process in Somalia. As you know, there have been ongoing discussions in the Security Council about the peacekeeping operation. Not much progress has been made due to the reluctance of some of the important members of the Security Council, particularly the permanent members, and some others, to prevent or to want to ensure that before a peacekeeping operation is deployed, that we have a viable and credible political process, and that the peacekeeping operation should be monitored. Now, the political process is currently led by the UN Political Office for Somalia. This is led by a special representative of the Secretary General, the former President of Mauritania, President Ould Abdallah. And this talks, I'll talk a little bit later, just an assessment of where this process is at the moment, when it's being carried out or taking place in Mogadishu, or in the Bushi. As Deputy Minister also mentioned, on Monday, the Security Council adopted a resolution, a Chapter 7 resolution on piracy. As members, we know that in the last few years there has been an upsurge of piracy in Somali waters on the coast, which has prevented particularly humanitarian supplies to enter Somalia. So the Security Council adopted a Chapter 7 resolution individual member states to take action against fighting in Somali forces. If I may just talk a little bit about the security situation, I think from our perspective, I think it's even according to UN assessment, the security situation and the humanitarian situation is worse than at any other time in the last 17 years. Over the last year, since 2007, we've seen more than 6,000 civilians killed in the fighting. Up to 1 million Somali civilians have been displaced internally and forced to flee the country. According to the UNHCR, about 2.6 million Somalis are in critical need of assistance. A situation not only fueled by the conflict but also by France and France. We've seen a severe drought in the south central Somalia over the last year, and we've seen also that the evacuation is the level of 5,000 the UN issued a 2008 consolidated appeal for Somalia, which amounts to about $450 million. Very little, of course, has been forthcoming in terms of developing on the credit by donors. And as you say, that the high levels of insecurity has also led to a significant impediment to the delivery of humanitarian aid. Chairperson, Honourable Members, we also maybe just to give an update of where we are on the AMISOM, the Africa Mission in Somalia, which was approved last year. Either the EU and also supported by the UN Security Council. On 19 January this year, the Security Council of the EU extended the mandate of the EU mission for further 6 months. And to date, we have only seen 2 countries contributing, Uganda and Burundi, and the total number of troops contributed has about 2,200 troops. There has been no other country that has indicated the willingness to contribute. I think part of it has to do with the very insecurity and the lack of security, the viable political process. There has been some attacks on AMISOM, but as we know, there's no real significant casualties. Now, just to come back to the UN talk, the talk started on 11th of May 2008. It was attacked and led by the UN SRSG, former President Ahmed Abdullah. Now, these talks are not face-to-face talks. The UN is basically the go-between between the two countries. There are some serious difficulties in the talks, part of it relating to internal differences between the two factions and how to deal and to ensure the Ethiopian the withdrawal of the Ethiopian forces from Somalia. As I said, the divisions between the TFG and the ARF that are also weighing the talk. From an ARF perspective, we can see that even the fact that there are great significant gains on the ground, military ground, military gains on the ground, is constituting a full factor, which is strength in the hand of the hardliners. Within the TFG, the difference is pertains to the extent to which they need to reach out to the opposition to the government. The Deputy Minister said we also need to talk a little bit about the regional and global dynamics. I think from our perspective, to talk about the resolution of the conflict in Somalia without dealing with the regional dynamics, I think it's really difficult. Because we see that many of the countries, the conflicts between countries are interlocked. And it's really important that we look at the regional dimension as well. So we would like to just present perhaps a stakeholder analysis of all the main regional players that are playing an important role at the moment. Ethiopia, as you know, has intervened in 2007. But its intervention is really facing significant difficulties, partly due to the financial burden and the casualties. It has made the government eager to withdraw its forces. Of course, this withdrawal will depend on the kind of security arrangements that Somalia. As you know, Ethiopia's interests are driven by the historic tensions between the two countries, which, as I said earlier, dates back to 1948, and the question of the fate of Somalia and the place of the Oromo region in the relations between the two states. Eritrea supports the ARF, and really its own interests are driven by the border conflict with Ethiopia. Kenya has played a very positive and constructive role in terms of hosting and leading some of the peace process. The last of which was the Mogadishu peace process, which resulted in the, as I said, in the formation of the PRC. Of course, Kenya has also been a significant player in terms of receiving and hosting Somali refugees, particularly in the eastern Kenya region, the Dabab area. Of course, also it has own fears pertaining to the international community related to the rest of Somalia. Djibouti, in the pre-colonial times, as you know, was part of the rest of Somalia. a significant population of the Kadabusi sub-clan of the Deer clan of Somalia. And of course, Djibouti now is supported and also engaged in bringing. Assisting to bring peace to Somalia. It is also a serious effort, particularly the Afghan peace in the 2000s. In terms of the global players outside the immediate region, the United States, we thought of mentioning, and as you've probably seen in the media, there's been by the U.S. military to deal with the Islamists or the Al-Shabaab. There's been some aerial bombardment of some parts of Somalia. The last incident being the killing of Hassan Fairo, a significant player in the Shabaab movement. And of course, the U.S. interests really are driven by war on terror or fighting against Al-Qaeda or trying to prevent an Al-Qaeda trade agent from emerging in Somalia. We thought of that, Honourable Chairperson, just to conclude with some of the challenges that I think we face in terms of the peace process. I've already alluded to some of them, but the important ones, of course, are the divisions within the ARS, between the hardliners and the ones willing to negotiate, between Sheikh Awais and Sheikh Ahmed, the Doha, the Asmara group, also between the CFD, between the Prime Minister and the President, then, of course, the capacity of the CFD to sustain itself in the event of the Ethiopian withdrawal. And the security mechanisms that are established to replace that becomes vital. Then we also have the real help of the president, who's not been well over the last year or two. The continuing insurgency, and of course the continuous disintegration of opposing parties on the ground. From our perspective, I think the important part in terms of the way forward in the peace process. We need an agreement on the broad-based government. Clearly, the CFD is not a legitimate, credible entity. It's inviting or invitation of Ethiopia in 2007 to enter the country has really left the decrease in its credibility in the eyes of the Somali people, population, and this policy is rooted in the historic context, the Ogaden, the war of 1977. The next step, of course, is the Ethiopian withdrawal, and in relation to that, of course, is the establishment of viable and credible security arrangements. These may not necessarily be international forces, today. Then we need to look at the strengthening of the institutions, the strengthening of the central government. We'll have to deal with the regional conflict dynamics. Looking at the relations between all the countries, the CIA, Ethiopia, Somalia, and of course Djibouti as well. And then, of course, from our perspective, we think that it's necessary for us to continue our bilateral engagement with the CFP and other not appointed in Somalia. That, in essence, under the service of our presentation.
Honorable Hajjaj, Mewa, and Honorable Tony, and Sibanda.
My question is that you have outlined positions of countries around Somalia and, of course, the stance of the USA. What I see missing is what is the position of the European Union on Somalia.
Now, what I'm copy.
Me?
What did you say? But your presumption there that you had forces stop the one.
Sorry.
I rather think.
Maybe he's younger than me.
Okay, can I call it a presumption or a point that you make here? What did you make about other forces on the side of Somalia? As you want to say, whatever. I'd like to know from you, the department, in this case, we don't have any diplomatic relations, because we are aware of the fact of the nature of our relations with Somalia. You say in the next word that China has the United Nations is the focal point of international consideration on Somalia. What do you mean by focal point? You say resources, whatever you mean. But what do you mean by China is a focal point of discussion or whatever at the United Nations? Do you, Chair, these are clarity. Can we come back to some other issues? Do you allow us to?
Yeah, we'll do that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, through you, first of all, I think the document was very interesting and very well prepared, so my congratulations. However, there seems to be an omission in the report that you present us with, and I speak here, if I might just say, from some background experience of a visit I made several months ago to the Refugee Centre of the Department of Home Affairs in the foreshore, where on the day that I visited, the majority of the refugees seeking asylum actually came from Somalia. And we know that the Somalis in South Africa are one of the focal points of the recent xenophobic violence, particularly this problem. And yet there's nothing. That is one of the collateral consequences of the failed state in Somalia, which is extraordinary. Think of those people coming all the way to South Africa, how far we are from there, which perhaps underlines the point that Mr. Yankovic made, that we shouldn't be involved in trying to seek some kind of resolution if possible in a very difficult circumstance. So, but how are we going to do so? As you said, we don't have any diplomatic representation there. We haven't, and I understand why we haven't, because we're very overstretched, contributing a single soldier to an AU peacekeeping force, which is, on your estimation, two-thirds under strength. And apart from our presence at the United Nations, are we, in fact, doing anything beyond contributing Ambassador Tomorrow to this particular mission? My second point is this, and it's obviously foremost in the minds of the United States and Ethiopia in terms of their intervention there. How real or relevant would you say the threat is of the Islamic courts and the areas of jurisdiction they control, or might control in the future, actually providing the safe haven for al-Qaeda and international terrorism? Do you think that is a credible threat? If so, how would you rate it, and what are the consequences going forward in the current situation in Somalia?
I have Spanner?
Yeah.
Thank you, Chairperson. Deputy Minister, I'll start by maybe commenting and then also to ask. You see, there is a confusion about the issue of Somalia. Like the Cold War in Somalia, and also the militarization of Somalia by the United States of America, which led to warlords. And I wonder, which dipstick or yard do they use to engage or to evaluate whether there is really real Al-Qaeda operatives there? Because why I'm raising that question, same thing applies with Saddam Hussein. They were looking for the weapons of mass destruction. Yes, they realized that there's nothing. I believe that that's why they did advance to attack it, because there's nothing. While Korea accepted that there is those weapons of mass destruction, but it's done nothing. For an example, a few days ago, there was an article in Egypt Mail Guardian, whereby it was issued that Israel do have nuclear weapons, but nothing said. The focus is which South Africa's public saga. And then come to the issue of South Africa. I'm a little bit concerned about how ourselves and also the local media, how they project themselves in terms of xenophobic. For an example, the very same people from Somalia who are so vocal about whatever. Please, I mustn't be seen as a person who's perpetuating this thing of xenophobic. I don't like it. But the really problem, which we must ask, why the very same people are very much arrogant about South Africa, while they are in South Africa? They are here in South Africa, but they speak in. They don't want any help from us. They don't want to be addressed by us. They want to be addressed by United Nations. But they are in South Africa. Same applies to Tsvangirai. He said, I'm making an example. He doesn't want to do. He doesn't want anything from us. But while he's uttering this statement, while he's in South Africa, so there are some questions which are supposed to be addressed on that one. That what is right and what is correct. So maybe if the Deputy Minister can clarify us on some of these issues. Then the last one, that if there is a role which is played by the African Union, does it have any impact? Thank you, Chairperson.
I'll come to you.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentation. I just want to maybe on a theoretical level, on the one hand, I presume the approach after 9/11 subsequently is multilateralism. Now, if we evaluate your presentation today and say, okay, if we use the conventional definition of a failed state, and if it's to, say, create a situation where there is improvement like the Liberia model, it is, do we have enough stakeholders involved? Because I'm worried if the Chapter 7 decision by the Security Council is going to be the approach, that means there will be unilateral action with regard to the security situation. And all your political players won't necessarily buy into that. So my question is really multilateralism. If that is the approach, in terms of the present players involved, are we having everybody on board to get a situation like Liberia?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Mine, there are two questions that need some clarity on. The first one revolves around the statement in the presentation, which is saying that all stakeholders must be involved. Who are these all stakeholders? So, a little bit of who is who there, and their capacity to influence a future. Because sometimes you can have all stakeholders and some don't have capacity to do anything. So I just want to know who are these stakeholders. Secondly, I'm one of those who, whenever the United States gets involved, I get worried. And I'm putting my cards straight forward. I get worried because their conception of some of the realities in the world and in Africa, it's sometimes hogwash. They don't conceptualize the world the way many people conceptualize it. And when they intervene with that narrow perspective
of the danger to the Americans. Right? And sometimes that is not very helpful. And I'm suspecting that even the question of these Al-Qaeda, it is just the American way of looking at the Al-Qaeda. And even in America now, in fact, that kind of vision is no longer acceptable to the majority of Americans themselves. So whilst all of us fight this international terrorism, the way in which we look at it is not exactly the same. We just look at anybody as if he's a terrorist. So I want just to get the American way of thinking there in terms of, you know, having, they are even having their planes going into a country unilaterally and just do the necessary bombing. I'm not very sure what their intentions are. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I just want to make a comment on what bothers the two honourable members there. That let's hope and pray that the change that the president, I mean the president, the new presidential candidate in America, Mr. Warren, the change that he's talking about perhaps will, you know, we
may modify.
Yeah, it may. So hopefully, you know, let's just hope for that. Yeah. Now, at any rate, my question is this. You know, looking at all this, this whole mess and the same game that we're talking about here, my question is, how do you see this thing? You know, how do you see this mess? How do you see this being resolved? I mean, do you see, what is the way forward here that can really make any difference whatsoever? And then the other thing is, I'm just worried that we have here Somali refugees, or whatever you want to call them, the immigrants that are here, that they were referring to, for instance, also vocal in Holland. They are here, and yet, really, there's no government back home where they come from. You know, there's nothing there. Yeah. So this is a matter of concern to us. You know, what do we do as South Africa if things happen with regard to these Somalis who are here, really? And they're raising questions. They are raising serious questions and concerns, you know, their presence here. What are they here about and all the kind of things? So, how do we have people like that here? And then, meantime, there's no government that, from where they come from, with whom we could deal in case of serious problems with them. Thank you.
Thank you. Just to add on to the Honourable Leon's question and perhaps related to Dr. McKinney's question, has the department got any feel for how many Somalis are in the country? I mean, do you talk to the department terms? Because it surely is important. I mean, the only thing we need about Somalis is they're, you know, shopkeepers are victims of the imperative violence. But there seems to be a large number of them if you look at the protests they held. And there must also be implications for Al Qaeda connections, all sorts of things. I presume it's in our interest to keep tabs on how many Somalis are in our country. From a positive and a negative perspective. So I just wondered whether the department had a feel for that.
Thank you, Minister.
Thank you. I'm going to try and answer some or talk to some of the questions raised very broadly, and I'm going to ask Graham to answer some of the more detailed questions about the community. But I think the question that has been raised about the models that are in our country. There are a number of different nationalities in this country. There are a number of Somali people who have entered our country, who have established themselves, who have established lives here. They appear to be quite a well-organized community, as we've seen. But there are also communities from all over the rest of Africa here. And the reason many people come here is they see an opportunity to better their lives. And that is simply the situation in which we find ourselves. I don't think there's anything particularly sinister in a person seeking to better their lives in another place. And so I'm not entirely sure that I'm able to answer the question, why are the Somalis here, over and above that general observation that people come here because it looks to them that they can achieve a better life. I think what our colleague Dr. Latuli said is correct. There is no government to speak of in Somalia, and this is one of the difficulties. And that leads me to the next answer that I'd like to give, which is why South Africa has not committed itself to troops in Somalia. We feel in the absence of an institutional framework, we can't send peacekeeping forces in a place where peace does not exist, where there's no framework for them to operate. However, what we have done is we have sent a military attaché to Addis to assist in the planning processes around the matters in order to get to a better and more peaceful situation and to promote the peace process and take it forward. So we have actually contributed in that way, but not in the Somalia's territory itself. The question of Al-Qaeda, I would like Graham to mention because he has some further information on that. I would also like to refer to him some of the matters around the China issue that was raised by Mr. Ram Govan. However, I think it is fair to say that we have adopted and we will continue to adopt this multilateral approach. We work through the African Union in its decision-making power structures as we do in the United Nations. We believe that that is the way forward, that we get people together to work together, particularly people in the region, to solve the problems that are there. The problems are huge, it is absolutely clear. The problems are huge, and many of the stakeholders, as has been evidenced from the presentation, have been excluded in the past. As to the nature of the stakeholders, well, it's everybody who's involved there. If you exclude people, as we know in our own experience, you don't have a solution that is bought into by everybody, and you have a potential for conflict in the future. So by all stakeholders, we mean those people that have an influence or a constituency or a power base in that country in order to negotiate a solution and a peaceful way forward. It is not an easy situation in Somalia, that is very clear. The answer to the question about how many Somalis there are in South Africa, I don't think we have a figure. And also you find that some people are of Somali descent, but maybe South African citizens now and so on, so it's a bit difficult. But of course we do keep closely in contact with the Department of Home Affairs in these matters. I'd like to ask Graham to deal with the matter of the African Union position as well as the threat of Al-Qaeda in the region and some of the questions around other people's involvement, other countries' involvement in Somalia, including China and the United States. Thanks.
Yes, thank you, Deputy Minister. Chairperson, just on the issue of the focal point, what we refer to there is, in the Security Council, there are various lead point countries on a particular theme or a country on the agenda of the Security Council. China is a lead or focal point for Somalia. So it leads on all aspects related to the question of Somalia, would lead the drafting of resolutions, would lead the discussions, in the subcommittee format, that goes into the broader Security Council. So that's what we meant by the focal point, on Somalia. On the question of Al-Qaeda, it's a very difficult one. Now, we've in the department have tried to make sense of this claim or allegation, and we've engaged with a number of actors, both people close to the U.S. government, analysts that are particularly involved in the analysis of this issue. And our sense is that, I mean, if you do a survey of opinion and expertise, I mean there's an overwhelming consensus that there's no real threat of Al Qaeda in Somalia, and that cuts across all spectrums of opinion. If you do a bit of a survey of the expertise, I think the problem that one faces in the current context, the global context, I think one must locate what is happening in terms of the emergence of the sixth Islamic court in Somalia. You must locate it in the particular context of that country. Now, the courts, as far as we are concerned, are a response to a situation that secular political movements have not been able to deal with. Political parties have failed, the state institutions have failed, and this is a response of local people, and they have had the support of the local people. So you have to deal with it in that context. You can't come in and say, make a generalization, oh, because Afghanistan, the Taliban had a similar emergence, and therefore you put one and one together and suddenly it becomes two. So you can't do that. From our perspective, I think the Somali society is a particular society. There are specific and unique dynamics within the society which we think make it very difficult for Al Qaeda to take a hold in a broad sense. But of course, I mean, we can't deny that given the fact that there's no state institutions, no monitoring capacity, that the territory could not be used as a transit territory to do other things, in Somalia. That we've seen with the reports on the bombings in Kenya and in Tanzania. I mean, it's a fact. It's actually been established that Somalia was used, but it's never been used as a sustainable safe haven for Al Qaeda. And I think we are pretty clear. And many of now, even American academics have criticized the policy on this because it doesn't help to bomb in the name of the war on terror. When at the time we are trying to make peace, it galvanizes the population, it humiliates them in terms of how they perceive themselves and how the international community perceives them as terrorists. So that policy really, from our perspective, is problematic. I just wanted to make that point. The question about the AU position, of course, the difficulty in the AU is the fact that because of the regional dynamics between Eritrea and Ethiopia, has made it very difficult to really deal with the Somali in particular in the later phases of the conflict, to have a serious, strong consensus position in the AU on Somalia because of the differences between member states, on that. And of course, in terms of the perceptions of the AU among the Somali stakeholders, the role players, of course, it's also a problematic one because many of them, particularly the ones in the opposition now, see the AU as partial to Ethiopia. And I think it makes it very, very problematic, of course, in that sense, if you were to ask or push for an AU role in the mediation or the peacemaking process, I think it would become problematic because of that perception among some of the key Somali stakeholders on the role of the AU and the perceived closeness to the Ethiopian position on this issue. So there was a question on how do we see the mess being involved, basically what is to be done. I think that is an issue that has I think baffled all of us for the last, I think, 15 years now. Our sense is that perhaps we have to have modest objectives and build on them incrementally. I think what we've seen over the last 14 years or 15 or 17 years is a serious decentralization in Somalia. Yeah? I mean, you have had a collapsed state and a collapsed government, but it doesn't mean that in large parts of Somalia we have not had governance at a very localized level. And things have happened. I mean, if you look at the study, the Somali economy, I mean, it's a vibrant one. It's a vibrant privatization of telecommunications, you know, the livestock, you know, economy is vibrant, to large, depending, of course, on the drought cycles and how it affects, you know, the livestock and also the agricultural sector. But it's been there. I think it's then to build on that, you know, instead of perhaps, I mean, I think we tried perhaps, and I think this is part of the effort now of the UN, if you look at the strategy, is to really be modest about what you need to achieve, is to build, you know, from what has been achieved, even in the absence of a government, a central government, and build on that and then start building towards the top, instead of starting with a grand vision of we'll create a state, but we don't look at the foundations and the pillars of that. And I think, I mean, many have argued, I mean, if I may, just, you know, in terms of the, you know, the differences between, you know, the institutionalist approach and the functionalist approach to state building. And I think people are looking at the functionalist approach to it now, and then from that, you know, build your institutions, you know, gradually as you go about. So that's I think, you know, where one should perhaps start, is to move away from the Big Bang approach, but rather look at, you know, but it will also take time and resources and engagement by all in the international community, including us. I think we have said to our Somali counterparts, the ones that we've interacted with, that, I mean, we are willing to help with the things that we have learned and experienced in southern Sudan in terms of our capacity building project. In the Congo, we are willing to bring that expertise, you know, to their efforts to build a viable and a functioning, you know, state and its institutions. So that's, I think, more or less where I think we would be going. And in terms of the stakeholders, as the Deputy Minister said, I think it's everybody and everybody. It cuts across Islamic movements, Islamic charities. It cuts across clan groupings. So all of those things, you know, add to the complexity of the thing. But we have to engage them, because those are the people that have constituencies. Some of them do exceptional work in terms of, you know, dealing with the humanitarian needs of the people, sometimes without the assistance of the international community. So those are.
I think we've answered all the questions, Chairperson.
Just a minute, so there's a following up on this issue of everybody being a stakeholder. I'm reading something here saying that I'm just talking in the middle, or I'm reading something that you said. After the collapse of the state in 1991, the world has employed the language of and sentiment of the same Sudani allegiance along kinship ties, but built their authority on the power of the gods. These warlords have maintained their authority by preventing the emergence of a functioning state. They therefore participate in the peace process in order to hold political office and access external resources, but ending the conflict does not appear to be an original goal. Now, if you have stakeholders like that, are they real stakeholders? If the motive for their engagement, it has nothing to do with the issue at hand. It has to do how much can we put our hands on the resources. I just want to follow up on the issue of everybody and everyone, the stakeholder. These are people that are not motivated by the interest, so are they real stakeholders? Do we want to argue that we should be continuously engaging them? Or should we look for real stakeholders who have a genuine interest of resolving the conflict? And maybe we should find a way to deal with the other elements in the process of finding a solution. Honorable Kalako?
Since the official have alluded to us having some counterparts who are dealing with in the situation, I will take it if I said you correctly. I would take it maybe when the South African government through the foreign affairs interacts in the situation. Who are these counterparts? Do we recognize the transnational and also this question will apply when you look at how does the AU or UN, when it deals with that situation, also mainly looking at the who actually recognize them by this in American culture, which you are able to do. Because in a situation like that, you can't just be with every group in the house. Yeah.
No, we'll be engaged in it. I mean, I can
any other questions from now?
No.
I'm having difficulty hearing.
I'm just trying to see from the documentation you have the population of the Somalia. We talked about all we know. Like they've killed off millions of them. Terrible. I mean, 2 million. 2 million people have been displaced.
Yes, about.
And that. You mentioned the number of soldiers, the population, which is particularly high. But you don't say what it's possible.
I don't think that's our document. That's not our document.
Parliamentary Research Unit.
I don't
know. I want to make some comments on Somalia and then change the topic to emphasis. Firstly, I think I can understand the department not being able to present issues as we would as parliamentarians. I think the reference to an implosion in the faith system is a consideration. We cannot discount the reality that there is a struggle for space, and therefore we need Islamic movement. And the question of the Sharia law, which is a factor to take into consideration. And what I want to leave is another issue of China. And I'm concerned about this because there's a new phenomenon in international relations called China as a powerful country. And the question that she can initiate in a multilateral institution in the United Nations, I would be entrusted with the responsibility of championing the cause of Somalia, when in my opinion, he is part of the problem. In Somalia or in Somalia or Sudan. And it will undertake such initiatives, I think it's under contradiction. I just wanted to make these two. I guess you can't make it, but we can make it. But I'm coming back to the question of the Somali people and ourselves. This is not sound bites, but if it is going to be used as sound bites, I suggest it be used creatively. You see, at this stage in South Africa, we who have pioneered in the last decade or more the question of racism, xenophobia, and other related matters. A country that has pioneered a discussion by the Human Rights Commission and ourselves in the Philippines, the question of xenophobia. I think it is not only superfluous, but I think it is bordering on an insulting situation. Where you have a group of people who become refugees or asylum seekers or whoever they are, who in fact bite the hand that feeds them. As a member of a party, we feel absolutely insulted by what our people are doing to refugees. We feel humiliated that fellow South Africans can brutalize other human beings on the African continent, from the African continent, when we are in the forefront as a country, not as a party, as a government, to lead the processes of a free trade area for SADC, as a free custom, a common custom union for SADC, free movement of people for SADC, and potentially a free currency area for SADC, in a knowledge that SADC, strengthened like this, will in fact be the strengthening force or a building block for the African Union. We who are in the forefront, I'm not saying it is only our idea for the African Renaissance, regeneration, and global coexistence, that our own people could engage in this kind of vulgarity, violent vulgarity against common Africans. Having said that,
I think it is grossly improper, especially for the Somalis in the Western Cape, to take up the position of a holier-than-thou role that it seeks to disregard the presence of an existing government, our government, which is playing such a fundamental role in the reorientation of values and systems. To say that you want to have nothing to do with the South African government, especially if it is reorientation, because it does nothing for us. I mean, this is wrong. This should be communicated to our people in the area, because in relationship to the total population of so-called refugees in our country, they are a handful. They are a handful because the media has referred to 50 to 100,000 refugees being so discursive, are being affected. But when it is convenient, and I'm taking it that the media is lying, that there are in excess of 3 million refugees in our country. The question is, where are the rest? Where is the balance of the 3 million? Are they persecuted? If they are not persecuted, are they integrated into our society? If they are not in refugee camps, where are they? So what I'm saying is to the department that I think some aggressive stances should be taken, even though there is no sign of an existing government to deal with in Somalia. But I suggest that we take the initiative to do this. Now, I think, just to conclude, we do not only distance ourselves to the kind of vulgar violence that has been engaged in by our own people for Southern Africa. We have not only distanced ourselves, we condemn it. We have arrested 1,400 plus people. Are going to be prosecuted very soon as part of this government's policy. And I am saying that what has become repugnant to us is equally becoming repugnant from the hands of the Somalis, who are saying that they disregard and they do not want to be helped by our government. Now I am saying, and I am not saying this on behalf of the ANC, but I am saying this as a head of the ANC, that this is what sustains me. The kind of commitment that we have for a value system based on non-racism, based on non-xenophobic tendencies and other related practices for the whole continent. When we say that our foreign policy, and this pertains to our department, when we say that our foreign policy is rooted in the interests of Africa and human rights culture, we're not going to be the instruments of negating that. There's a constitutional authority for ourselves which guarantees that. Now, from the chair, I'm saying I made another open statement. And, for the people, how do the system work? We don't bite the hand that feeds. Correct. Good. Non-baptized Christian. No doubt. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. And I'm not saying we are condescending. And I'm not saying that we are giving handouts. We're saying that our inability or unwillingness to take a stern stand of having body control is a fact that we have said over and over again, that we have got to live with this reality. The reality that South Africa will be a destination for people who seek a better life from the rest of the region. The President, in response to a question from opposition parties in Parliament, addressed the issue of our incapacity to have border controls in place. And the President is on record for having said, we as South Africans have got to begin to learn to live with it, that this is a reality that is going to face us, South Africa. And I don't see how today we can squirm when we have a policy position to do this. Now, please, gentlemen, men, and ladies, men of the media, it's not a soundbite, but if we've got to use it as a soundbite,
the whole mix, maybe the whole soundbite.
I'm a running mate, because I'm happy that I've been to the church to see how we can do this.
Sorry, we can't hear. Sorry.
Yeah, definitely, sir. Thank you very much for the interest. I've just quickly gone to the church, and I'm happy that I've been to the church to see the commandments myself. And two things that come into my mind. First, in the interpretation where we talk about the 14 Somalia situation, it is clear that Somalia is similar like many African countries. And now the question that comes into my mind is that since they won't start the Somalia and the division of Somalia and all this, this group, how do they sustain the war if you look at the level of economy? Where do they get the money to buy all this money? Who's feeding? That is the second I have. But just on a light note, the Somalians are still demanding for UN protection. But unfortunately, they want also a non-management. And unfortunately, this is South Africa. UN doesn't have any
sovereignty.
They're giving them a hard time.
Just one thing which there's one thing that I think through can be conveyed to another department to initiate, that is the Department of Communication. Now, the media, including our own public workers, uses words that are derogatory to the Africans that have come to our land. And this, because it's watched by many of our own citizens, they internalize it as if we are describing them as such. One of the words, in reality, they come from some other place. Huh? And they are used every day on news, every day. And in English, they talk about illegal aliens. That's a very serious word in English, which actually are describing these people we want to reintegrate into our community. Every day they also watch that, and apart from being integrated, we are being described as if we will never belong. And that I want you to really convey, to say, can we also, just at least our own public broadcaster, we might not be able to influence the other media fraternity, but our own public broadcaster should actually desist from using words. These people are Africans, and when we become one Africa, one voice, one continent, how will we then say they are illegal aliens or Gematlante? Right? Because where will they be coming from when you have one particular vote? So this is not for you to reply, really.
Okay.
Just to convey, to say, this should not happen. Well, our own media, I think the public broadcaster here, they can also convey that to say we don't feel a real comfortable in those ways that are being used. Thank you.
Deputy Minister, we're coming to you, but let me deal with that. There's an issue that we've been raising consistently. The impact of xenophobia on our foreign policy. If you can reflect on that, I think we've raised this issue since 2005, after the committee had a public hearing and it was sent to the department. You look at this issue and discuss the task
because we believed and we argued at the time that the progress was about Home Affairs giving an ID document or refusing an Afghan document. It goes to the heart of our foreign policy. And to what extent has this particular event of the last few weeks challenged South Africa's foreign policy?
Thank you very much indeed. I think there's been some very interesting questions and a lot of comments. I will endeavor to answer some of the questions and maybe engage a little bit also on some of the comments, because I think some of them raise very interesting points. The first one is about the stakeholders. Now, the purpose of an engagement with such stakeholders that you mentioned, people who have indicated their willingness to secure public office and benefit from it. I think the purpose of any such engagement would actually persuade them of a different view. I mean, that has been our philosophy throughout our own history as a government and also as a movement. But it's also something that occurs at the multilateral level. So the purpose of bringing everybody in was so that you do not have people standing outside able to jettison a peace process, but rather bring them in and engage them on the kind of principles and the kind of solutions that we believe are the way forward. So I'm not pretending it's an easy task, but certainly one would want to engage with those groupings and authorities that have a similar view, but also not only speak to the ones with a similar view, but to those that have a differing view, and to bring them in into the conversation and into be part of a peaceful solution. So that is as much as I can say there. While I do believe that it is a very difficult task, I think one has to begin from that premise. The South African government does recognize the transitional government. If you recall from our presentation, The TFC, the Federal Charter, and the government arose out of the one last attempt at a peace process, which was in Mbagathi in Kenya in 2004. As we said, this has not been entirely successful, but it has resulted in a government, even though the state behind the government does not really exist. So I think what we're saying there's a number of most countries, in fact, recognize the transitional government process, and in fact that peace process that was established at the Kenya talk. But we've had a paralysis in the interim that have not enabled the government to move forward into developing and creating institutions of state. And so I think that is what we're saying about South Africa's position with regard to the government. But you point out quite correctly that we don't have diplomatic representation there for all the reasons that we've also mentioned. The size of the Somali population is not known to us. There is no proper data. We can give estimates. The diaspora is also an estimated number. So we're not really able to give a final figure on how many people live in Somalia. And that would be another function of a state that doesn't really exist. Well, somebody talked about 12 million people, you know, in that sort of ballpark. But as I say, one can't say that there's hard data on the matter. I would just like to point out, I think we have perhaps cast this sentence regarding China as a focal point incorrectly. The purpose of stating that China is a focal point in the Security Council is almost an administrative thing. Each country is given a task. It's a way of arranging the work. It has nothing to do with being a champion of the thing. It's a way of arranging the Security Council's work. Countries are given countries on the Security Council are given other countries on which to administratively deal with the matters that come forward. So I think we must just make that clear. I hope that is now clear. Now, on the question of xenophobia, I think we need to reiterate once again, the government and the majority, the vast majority of the South African population's feeling of repugnance against acts of violence against people from other countries. I think we have to say that categorically, and I think everybody around this table has reiterated that. The challenges that you raise, I think, are matters for further discussion around what the communities here are saying and doing. I don't think these are matters for the Department of Foreign Affairs or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to talk about or to pass judgment on. I think they're matters that will engage us in the coming months, and will also engage those communities as we try and as we work hard in government and in civil society to reintegrate those people who are currently displaced into the communities in which they have been living and from which they come. And I think that is a debate that is going to exercise our minds as a South African community over the coming weeks. I certainly would like to respond to Mr. Nivola Vodwe on the matter of the language used by some members of the media and other commentators on this matter. And I'd like to agree with you that an alien is something that comes from outer space in the minds of some people, and we don't want that to reaffirm the prejudices that some few may have against people from other countries. So I think we can ask the South African Broadcasting Corporation to take this matter forward. We certainly will do so also in our communication with our counterparts in that field. And I would hope that the members of Parliament, perhaps yourself, Mr. Nivola Vodwe, would also write letters, maybe start a campaign to re-look at the way in which we are approaching this matter, particularly in the written and the spoken word. Now, the last question, Chairperson, I think is probably the most engaging one for this committee and for us at the Department of Foreign Affairs. And we really think we would welcome a debate on this matter amongst us. It is a debate that has begun in the Department of Foreign Affairs itself and amongst us. While xenophobia is not the phenomenon, if you could call it that, is not a foreign policy matter itself. There are obviously impacts on the implementation of our foreign policy. I was recently in Abuja, in Nigeria, to accompany the Deputy President on the Binational Commission, and we noticed in the press there and in other forums of civil society real questions about South Africa's position in this regard. We've reiterated, and I've done it again here today, our repugnance for the violence that has been perpetrated on members of different communities, and we'd like to continue to say that. But I think that we have a task ahead of us as a portfolio committee and as a department to debate these matters and to ensure that it does not affect the objectives that we have in our foreign policy, in the implementation of our foreign policy, but in the way we engage with our fellow African countries in our African agenda, which is one of the cornerstones of our foreign policy. So I think that is something that we can talk about, you know, into the future, and certainly engage in a very productive debate on. I'd like to ask, if I may, Chairperson, Mr. Maitland, to maybe come in on some things that I might have left out.
Maybe just the one question about the resources issue. I think one of the biggest sources of income, of course, is taxes. At roadblocks, taxes of humanitarian, you know, convoys. There's also the diaspora, of course. I mean, we can't deny that the diaspora also, you know, the linkages, the family linkages, because you also have to remember that there are strong, you know, family linkages that sustain some of these things. So those, in our understanding of it, would be some of the sources of income that sustain war, orders, and so on.
There's a question on the reputation of the
interim
government.
I think you answered it.
I thought I answered that one. We recognize the transitional federal charter and the.
There was an issue of where do we and how do we engage with I think that's related.
Oh.
No, I mean, there are various, as you know, in 2000, or you may know that in 2005, for example, we have had a Ambassador Makubela, who's now the current chief of protocol, when he was still high commissioner in Nairobi, for example, was appointed as presidential envoy to engage with the peace process or with the CFG around certain aspects. And he engaged with members of the CFG. We sometimes, as a department, are invited to attend international meetings. For example, there's the recent international contact group on Somalia, where there are representatives of the CFG. And then those occasions provide the opportunity for us to engage with members of the CFG. There are many other fora, I mean, the UN, the sidelines on the corridors of the UN. So there's many opportunities for us to engage with members of the CFG. As I said, I mean, in Asmara we have an embassy, an ambassador. The Asmara group is based at the hotel where the ambassador lived. I mean, there's plenty of opportunity, you know, for him to engage with members of the opposition as well, because I mean, it's only natural that he's there. They are concerned about or have an interest in South Africa and South Africa's role on the Somali issue. In Nairobi as well, you know, there's various fora and occasions where we do engage with the CFG at various levels, informally, and so on. So that's when I one way of answering the question. Okay.
Follow up on that.
Maitland.
To follow up on that one, you see here your document is that the Chinese oil company entered into a deal with President Yusuf. Mm. Now, how permanent is President Yusuf? How temporary is he? Whom does he represent? What area does he represent? Mm. What are the implications for Somalis, for Somalia, Somalia, right? In terms of contracts and bilateral agreements. Is it a bilateral agreement? Mm. Or is it a business deal? Mm. Basically, it's a business deal between the President. You refer to the President Yusuf of Somalia. Mm-hmm. And an oil company. What is the significance?
Mm. Well, okay. Well, I mean,
in terms of the validity of a contract, how valid is it? Why does it deal with it? Okay, I know it's difficult for the department to answer this question. But we are pleased with these conversations.
Yeah, sure.
And are you obliged to give us a presentation, which you have done substantially? But, we're not nitpicking, don't get me wrong. We're just disciplined and educated to answer that at the time.
When the deputy minister answers that, could you please come back to the deputy minister on the issue related to what Honorable Mewa raised, on the fact that you have Somalians. And say that it's not going to be in its government. How do you see that particular aspect? Because that's very important. That will inform how South Africa, not South Africa as a government, but how South Africans respond to that particular situation, because it has an inflammatory impact to exacerbate the problem that we have. Where we start hearing demands of a land. When we are struggling with our land restitution, that exacerbates the problem.
In terms, I think, in answer to the first, second question of Mr. Ram Gurbin, perhaps we could just say that we do recognise the transitional government. They are enabled, I would assume, in terms of international law, to engage in agreements. Of course, this will, should we achieve everything we wish to achieve as an international community in the peace process, some of those issues may be reviewed or revisited. But that would be up for a final government to decide upon, obviously. I mean, there's nothing that the international community can do, is what I'm saying, in the agreements that the president of Somalia makes with whomsoever he chooses. I don't know all the details about the agreement, but as is stated there, it relates to oil rights and so on in the territory. With regard to the Somalis don't want to deal, so Somali people who are living here don't want to deal with government, well, we would engage them on that, obviously, because they are dealing with government, whether they like it or not. I mean, it is our government who are putting in place the measures to deal with this problem. Our police services are arresting the people responsible for attacks. Our courts are processing in a specialized court system the perpetrators, or alleged perpetrators, I should say, of these crimes. Our Department of Home Affairs is dealing with interim measures to make sure people are documented properly. Our Department of Provincial and Local Government is dealing with emergency measures around the holding of the establishment of places for people to safely stay, and our entire government is dealing with the question of bringing those people back into their communities. So the state is ever present in the matters relating to the recent crisis. It would be we obviously will need to negotiate and talk with these people on these matters, but the state cannot be ignored in this area. I would hope that we would be able to engage and link with those communities in order to persuade them that the work that we are doing and the programs that we are setting in place will ultimately benefit them in the long term. Thank you.
Mr. Minister, I'm here to express. I was listening to the news this morning, and it quoted the chairperson of the Home Affairs, having said that Home Affairs has no capacity to deal with the current challenges. And I hear you saying that they will ask our colleagues in Home Affairs to do that. Now, the chairperson says we don't have capacity. Does that suggest that we will not be able to deal with that? Because if I listen to the two, one hand you have to go to these colleagues so they don't have the capacity to deal with the problem, to ask them to deal with the problem.
Which chairperson?
The chairperson of Home Affairs.
The chairperson of the Home Affairs Portfolio Committee.
Portfolio Committee.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Have said that in the round table yesterday.
Okay.
So how then do I... I'm raising this because I say in Alex, Deputy Minister, it's hard heat. My constituency is in Midway, it's hard heat.
Mm.
So I'm sitting with those two situations, heat very hard, both of them. Mm. So I'm saying, if you say to me that our colleagues in Home Affairs will come on board, and the chairperson here says to me, look, our hands are up in the air, how do you deal with this particular problem? How? And I'm putting you on the spot, I'm aware.
Yes. I'll be promoted to Minister of Home Affairs and I can come back and address you on the matter. But look, I believe that we obviously have challenges in that regard, but it would be better, I think, to get a proper engagement with the Minister of Home Affairs and discover exactly all the programs that they are putting in place to deal with this current crisis.
Sorry.
Yes.
This entire issue requires two things, and both they are slightly deficient on both of them. Firstly, the management, control, and the taking forward of the needs of refugees is the responsibility of a disaster management committee. It's not the department's responsibility. It's not Home Affairs' responsibility. But what is their responsibility together, politically, is to pronounce on government policy together in one voice, to repeat and repeat over and over again. And to proceed with the implementation of disaster management, which is to us, it's not their job. Because the sub-department of housing will be saying to us, you know, how do I house these so-called refugees? I don't have the budget for it. That falls under the disaster management. So, Comrade Sue,
yes.
Not what he's referring to, just being the other
okay.
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 But what is required is a common voice from all departments that this is government policy. And any departure from that government policy will be an abrogation of our own.
Okay.
Listening to you talk, I mean, I also have a part of Alex in my constituency, and we won it actually. From the the chair knows the details. We stood together the other day, it seems to me that our question really can't be answered by the Deputy Minister. I mean, in all good faith, he says that Home Affairs is a Home Affairs matter. And our question is whether Home Affairs can actually do anything positive and answer our questions. Would it not be useful to us, seeing the arteries of the matter of the refugees from Somalia and the problems in these various countries our neighbours have, to have asked Home Affairs to come and answer some of our questions?
Okay.
No, we'll deal with that. Let's left to see how it works out in front of him. But Deputy Minister, thank you very much. I just want to emphasize the fact that we will require your presence more than today in all other briefings. And just to draw your attention to the fact that the document that you presented to us says the presentation to the Portfolio Committee was to inform the Deputy Director General bilateral.
Yeah.
We're not presented to this document by Mr. Nkosi, nor by the Director General. We will want this document to be properly titled so that we know that the presentation. We want to insist that the presentation, whether the Deputy Minister is done by your officials or not, but the presentation will be there, be headed by a political office bearer. And that person must be present in that situation. The last thing that I want to draw your attention to, Deputy Minister. On the 19th of October 2006, the Department of Foreign Affairs was presented with the resolution of Parliament. I've raised this matter with the DG, and I have not received responses in those many times that I've raised it with him. It's a resolution regarding the extension of a contract. It says, Deputy Minister, the Department of Foreign Affairs, I'm just reading the recommendation that Parliament adopted. The Department of Foreign Affairs develops a coherent succession strategy or plan and present it to the Portfolio Committee on Foreign Affairs within a period of 6 months, calculated from the date of approval of this application by Parliament. The Department includes the implementation of the succession strategy or plan in their strategic plans. The Department of Foreign Affairs report annually on the progress in the implementation of the succession strategy. I'm drawing your attention, Deputy Minister, because the 6 months from the date of adoption, if I'm correct, I went through Bantu Education, so I might not calculate correctly, but if I'm correct, today, from 2006 today, the 6 months is probably coming during the elections. And that's not acceptable. This is a resolution of Parliament, and I've raised this thing several times to say that there's this report that is required. This report that is required. We have never received the report in the first 6 months from the day of this report. Neither have we received an annual update. I'm asking you for your intervention, that this is required, otherwise we'll be failing to do our responsibilities. With that note, the meeting is adjourned.
Okay.
Yes, you need to deal with this thing. This is becoming a crisis.
Thank you.